I feel obliged as a Hong Kong belonger to come out to protest to make the government realize that we meant business.
Another weekend, another mass rally in Hong Kong. It's Monday, August 19th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, a deadly Afghan bombing amid peace talks. Young Rohingya lacking needed education. Secrecy in the land down under. Young brides, scary teen movies. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Protesters rallied in Hong Kong again Sunday as anti-government demonstrations, now in their 11th week, continue. Mike O'Sullivan reports that the protests were first sparked by an extradition bill, but are now broadly aimed at maintaining Hong Kong's special status with China.
A sea of umbrellas and a peaceful show of force as tens of thousands of protesters spilled into the streets in defiance of authorities after Sunday's rally.
Because I just can't help it, of the history that happened this recent few months. I feel obliged, as a Hong Kong belonger, to come out to protest, to make the government realize that we meant business.
Braving the rain in a scene reminiscent of the Umbrella Movement protests of 2014. Now it's about an extradition bill with China that protesters say undermines Hong Kong's legal system. The bill was suspended but not withdrawn, and they worry that it could be reinstated. This 17-year-old girl was too young 5 years ago, but now has joined the protests.
And if the extradition law is passed, then we will really forever lose our freedom in Hong Kong. And that's why when I have the ability this time, I want to stand up and protect Hong Kong.
Last week's protests at the airport led to canceled flights and stranded passengers. Some say it hurt the movement.
We apologize for any inconvenience caused. And you can see that we try many ways, but the chief executive does not answer any of our demands, so we keep trying it.
Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam is the focus of the anger. The government has supporters who rallied Saturday. They say these protests hurt Hong Kong, now in danger of recession. There is also a danger that China will send in troops.
You know that if China strongly move in Hong Kong, I think that will destroy the one country, two system. That's the whole world, not just America, but also the Euro will against China and fight for us.
There is no other choice, said another at the rally.
Every one of us is scared, but we still have to try our very best to fight for our freedom.
Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Hong Kong.
These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit our website. That's voanews.com. Hong Kong residents protest peacefully in latest push for reforms. U.S. North Korea envoy to visit Japan and South Korea this week. In Kim's threats and appeasement, experts see move to manipulate Trump. Security laws making Australia a secretive state, according to media leaders. Rohingya refugee children missing out on education and a viable future. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and so much more when you visit our VOA Asia Facebook page, also at the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Authorities in Afghanistan say the death toll has risen to more than 63, with at least 183 injured in the overnight suicide bombing at a packed wedding hall in the capital, Kabul. The victims were mostly members of the minority Shiite Hazara community. Afghan Interior Ministry spokesman Nasrat Rahimi confirmed the casualty toll in a statement issued early Sunday, saying women and children were among the victims. Rahimi, in a statement he issued shortly after the attack, said the blast occurred just before midnight Saturday and police and ambulances quickly reached the site to transport victims to Kabul hospitals. President Ashraf Ghani condemned the overnight attack as an inhumane act, saying he has summoned an extraordinary security meeting to review and prevent such security lapses. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, political science professor and South Asia expert at Indiana University. He asked him about the latest attack and what effect it might have on the ongoing talks with the Taliban.
First, of course, this is a colossal tragedy, and it underscores the fact that ISIS has a foothold in Afghanistan, which is deeply disturbing for the entire subcontinent, given the presence of very large Muslim communities in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and even a sizable Muslim community in Sri Lanka. So the ripple effects will be felt throughout the region, quite apart from the tragedy that has again befallen Afghanistan. And on the talks themselves, my suspicion is the U.S. interlocutors will bring up this issue. The Taliban will no doubt dissemble and insist that they have nothing to do with ISIS, though one wonders about the credibility of such a claim. After all, they were the ones who nurtured al-Qaeda before 9/11 and refused to hand over Osama bin Laden despite the insistence of the United States. So consequently, I am somewhat skeptical about anything the Taliban says about ISIS.
What do you know about the relationship between the Taliban and ISIS, if any?
Well, at this point, unfortunately, we have made it so clear to our interlocutors that we are desperate to get out of Afghanistan. And consequently, we may tell the Taliban almost anything about ISIS and warn them about an involvement with ISIS. But they are likely to dissemble, and they are unlikely to give us what is called in the jargon of political science a credible commitment. A commitment that one can take to the bank. And thereby, I am somewhat jaundiced in terms of my view about any claim that the Taliban is likely to make. But it is a matter that we have to raise forthrightly with them.
Are we meeting the United States between the proverbial rock and a hard place, especially when it comes to troop withdrawal from Afghanistan?
We are definitely between a rock and a hard place, and in part this is of our own making, because we made it much too clear to the Taliban that we really are desperate to get out. And they consequently have the upper hand at the moment. After 18 years of war, we are no closer to completely defeating them, and in fact, we may even be worse off. And the president on too many occasions has made clear his interest in getting out of Afghanistan before 2020, maintaining a token force, perhaps some special operations, individuals and groups, and some intelligence assets. And so the Taliban knows that time is on their side, and they can get away with murder, quite literally.
Is there a way out here?
The way out here, that's the subject of a very long conversation. But the immediate issue is to induce Pakistan to end its support for the Taliban. And we have not been very successful in this endeavor and have only pursued it rather half-heartedly. And to also remind the Taliban that if they become hosts to yet another terrorist organization, the U.S., with reluctance, may be forced to come back with its allies, and it will not be pleasant. But I'm not sure that the Taliban genuinely believes that we have the intestinal fortitude to return to Afghanistan after 18 years of being bled, both in terms of blood and treasure.
Dr. Sumit Ganguly, political science professor and South Asia expert at Indiana University, speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. Happening now in Asia, Islamic State claims responsibility for that wedding bombing in Kabul that killed at least 63 and wounded 183. Afghanistan's Interior Ministry spokesman confirmed that casualty toll. The U.S. ambassador to Kabul, John Bass, in a tweet condemned the carnage. You can stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad to have you with us today as we begin a brand new week on VOA Asia. A study by the United Nations Children's Fund is finding that more than 500,000 Rohingya refugee children in Bangladesh's Cox's Bazar are not learning the life skills they need to prepare them for the future or to protect them from present-day abuse and exploitation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya children have been languishing in squalid, overcrowded refugee camps in Cox's Bazar for 2 years. Ever since a mass exodus of 745,000 refugees fleeing persecution and violence in Myanmar began. The UN Children's Fund reports more than 250,000 children up to age 14 are receiving a non-formal education, while more than 25,000 others are receiving none. Author of the UNICEF report, Simon Ingram, says adolescents are most disadvantaged. He says 97% of children aged 15 to 18 years, are not attending any type of educational facility, putting them at particular risk.
When you meet teenagers in the camps, they speak readily of the dangers they face, especially at night. When drug dealers operate and gang fights are reported to be a regular occurrence. Cases of trafficking are also being reported, although they are hard to quantify. The camps can be especially hazardous for girls and women.
UNICEF and partners have provided learning to more than 190,000 Rohingya refugees in more than 2,000 centers. These agencies are calling on the governments of Myanmar and Bangladesh to allow the use of their national educational resources to provide more structured learning for Rohingya children. Ingram tells VOA, UNICEF is appealing to Myanmar authorities to provide education to the children in the refugee camps. Until now, he says, the children have been taught in the Burmese language by volunteer teachers from the refugee population.
And with the best will in the world, that is not the same as having a properly trained teacher, someone who has experience of delivering the Myanmar government's own curriculum. So that's really what we're looking for, and those are the conversations that are now ongoing with the government in Myanmar, and we hope that we will receive a positive response to that.
Ingram says it is critical for refugee children to be taught in Burmese, as that is the language they will need if and when they return back to Myanmar. Unfortunately, he notes, Rohingya adolescents will continue to live in limbo until it is safe for them to go home. He acknowledges that going home does not appear to be a realistic possibility for the foreseeable future. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, security versus secrecy. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia. Thousands of people were left homeless when a fire raged through a slum in Bangladesh's capital city, Dhaka. The junior minister for disaster management and relief says 1,200 shanties were damaged. Officially, 3,000 were left homeless, as most media reports put that number at 10,000. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for this and much more. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, media organizations say Australia has become a secretive state that is actively restricting the press. The bosses of the country's major newspapers and broadcasters have made the claims at the first public hearing of a parliamentary inquiry investigating Australia's security laws and their impact on journalism. Phil Mercer in Sydney lifts some of the secrecy.
Media bosses in Australia say that journalists must be able to do their jobs without fear. The inquiry in Sydney was told that reporters who published stories based on leaked government documents were being treated as though they'd received stolen goods. The Australian Parliament's powerful Intelligence and Security Committee is investigating the impact national security laws have on press freedom. The probe was launched after the Australian Federal Police raided a newspaper journalist's home in Canberra and the headquarters of the national broadcaster, the ABC, in June, over stories based on leaked confidential documents. The raids were widely condemned as heavy-handed and an utter violation of a free media. The ABC was targeted for publishing stories on allegations of unlawful killings and misconduct by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. They were based on hundreds of pages of classified military papers. Media chiefs are calling for so-called public interest protections for reporters to be able to tell sensitive stories without fear of prosecution. Michael Miller, the executive chairman of News Corp Australasia, says national security concerns are unfairly outweighing the public's right to know.
We may not be living in a police state, but we are living in a state of secrecy. We have many laws that criminalise journalism. They are creating a secret society that most Australians would not recognise as our own.
Senior Australian Federal Police officers have insisted the raids on the media in June were in defence of national security, and that the compromise of sensitive material could cause exceptionally grave damage or serious damage to Australia's interests. Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton has stressed the importance of a free and open press in Australian democracy. The parliamentary inquiry into press freedom is expected to report its findings by October. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news break from VOA Asia. Tens of thousands of pro-democracy protesters marched peacefully through the streets of Hong Kong Sunday, the 11th weekend in a row of anti-government demonstrations. Heavy rain fell on the protesters, but the size of the crowd showed support for easing Beijing's control of the territory. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, about 650 million girls worldwide were married before age 18. UNICEF says that amounts to about 17% of the world's female population. These marriages often keep girls from completing their education and can lead to devastating psychological and physical consequences. Jesusa Manoni has more about the year-long project in which Voice of America met with child brides from Albania to Pakistan to Tanzania.
11-year-old Bobogai went from selling firewood and paper to becoming a wife so she could settle her mother's debt.
I was crying. I wanted someone to help, but we had no choice. The lenders were pressing hard.
More than 12 million underage girls like her get married every year, according to UNICEF.
I had not begun menstruating when I married. I started in my husband's house.
Some girls entering into early marriages are under pressure to continue cultural traditions. Others say they had limited options.
I married my daughter off because we had no place to live. Where could I keep her? If I was in a house with her, if I had my own house like now, of course I would have sent her to school. She would not have needed to marry at 11, 12, or 13. She could have been educated, found a job, or learned a trade.
Early marriages happen across societies. In the U.S., most states permit marriage before 18 if the individuals meet certain criteria. However, critics say many of these marriages take place to circumvent statutory rape laws that protect minors.
I met him about when I was like 13, 14. So one thing after another, after a few years, we just kind of ended up together. I got pregnant underage, and that was kind of what had us go ahead and get married so I wouldn't send him to jail.
The young wives are more likely to leave school, experience domestic abuse, and live in poverty compared to those who marry later, according to human rights activists.
I lost my childhood. I loved school and going to school. But they wouldn't let me.
As governments face international pressure to take action, individuals and groups are stepping forward to help young girls.
The night before the wedding, a local official came to our house to ask whether I wanted to marry. When I said no, he halted the ceremony.
Sultan Tumadam found joy in her married life, despite being forced into the union.
I had never met my husband. I didn't know him. With time, we got to know each other. I'm very happy now. Thank goodness.
But the case was different for many of the child brides VOA met over the course of this project. Now divorced or deserted, they are angry at losing their education.
I think if I had only continued my studies, I would not have to experience so much harassment from other people now. I could have found a good job.
Now mothers themselves, they say they regret their stolen childhoods and add they never want to see their children married young.
I am now fighting for my children so they don't end up like me. Someone has to fight for them.
The United Nations is trying to eliminate the practice by 2030. Jason Samelny, VOA News.
Scary folk tales and urban legends have always captivated people's imagination, especially the young. Now, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, a collection of short horror stories for children by author Alvin Schwartz and illustrator Stephen Gammell, has been adapted for the large screen by Oscar-winning producer Guillermo del Toro and director Andre Overdahl. Penelope Blue tells us during its opening weekend, the movie grossed over $20 million, proving once again that teen horror flicks are a lucrative genre.
In the movie adaptation of Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark by producer Guillermo del Toro, monsters are coming alive out of the pages of a haunted storybook and claim the lives of teenagers. The Oscar-winning producer and filmmaker has likened these tales to campfire stories.
We've got to stop it.
There are two types of horror movies, ones that are disturbing and they sort of scar your soul permanently. And then there is a different type of horror movie, which is like a roller coaster ride. It's fun and it's entertaining and is, really thrilling.
Filmmaker André Overdahl adapted the film from Alvin Schwartz's anthology of children's horror stories.
It's kind of a mix between a modern horror movie and a throwback to the Amblin movies I grew up with.
André Overdahl refers to the 80s Spielberg's influence of films such as Poltergeist, Goonies, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, where horror mixes with adolescent thrills and chills. But the story also borrows elements from 70s horror movies based on favorite Stephen King novels where supernatural forces are beckoned by the underdog, usually kids and teenagers, to exercise revenge, retribution on bullies, mean girls, and sinister corporations. Usually the underdog displays superpowers or opens the gate to unseen, otherworldly forces, as in the case of Stella, a smart, timid girl from a nondescript Midwestern town.
Sarah Bellows, tell me a story.
Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark is not the only retro horror to scare its way to success.
At least someone's happy I'm home.
According to the streaming network Netflix, Stranger Things, a scary series with a teen cast, roared into its third season with 40 million viewers binge-watching the show within the first 4 days since its debut. As for why do we crave horror movies?
Dread and suspense is this kind of wonderful thing that only exists in horror movies.
Sarah Bellows' book. When the stories write themselves and it all comes alive.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online, of course, at VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You can also find our program in its entirety on iTunes and SoundCloud. It's available there each and every day for you to download, take it with you, and listen as you do whatever you want to do during the day. You can also find us on the Radio Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Thanks to everyone there who's tuned in and listened to our program today. We also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Zainab Abdel-Rahman, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day ahead.